Joshua held his hand out to the creature. The creature reached out to Joshua and ever so gently took the Messiah's smaller hand in his great paw and wrenched Joshua off his feet, catching him in a hug and squeezing him so hard that his beatific eyes started to bug out. "Help!" squeaked Joshua. The creature licked the top of Joshua's head with a long blue tongue. "He likes you," I said. "He's tasting me," Joshua said. I thought of how my friend had fearlessly yanked the tail of the demon catch, of how he had faced so many dangers with total calm. I thought of the times he had saved me both from outside dangers and from myself, and I thought of the kindness in his eyes that ran deeper than sea, and I said, "Nah, he likes you." I thought I'd try another language to see if the creature might better comprehend my meaning. "You like Joshua, don't you? Yes, you do. Yes, you do. He loves his widow Joshua. Yes, he does." Baby talk is the universal language. The words are different, but the meaning and sound is the same. The creature nuzzled Joshua up under its chin, then licked his head again, this time leaving a steaming trail of green tea-stained saliva behind on my friend's scalp. "Yuck," said Joshua. "What is this thing?" "It's a yeti," said Gaspar from behind me, obviously having been roused from his trance. "An abominable snowman." "This is what happens when you fuck a sheep?" I exclaimed. "Not an abomination," Josh said. "Abominable." The yeti licked him on the cheek. Joshua tried to push away. To Gaspar, he said, "Am I in danger?" Gaspar shrugged. "Does a dog have a Buddha nature?" "Please, Gaspar," Joshua said. "This is a question of practical application, not spiritual growth." The yeti sighed and licked Josh's cheek again. I guessed that the creature must have a tongue as rough as a cat's, as Joshua's cheek was going pink with abrasion. "Turn the other cheek, Josh," I said. "Let him wear the other one out." "I'm going to remember this," Joshua said. "Gaspar, will he harm me?"
"I don't know. No one has ever gotten that close to him before. Usually he comes while we are in trance and disappears with the food. We are lucky to even get a glimpse of him."
"Put me down, please," said Josh to the creature. "Please put me down." The yeti set Joshua back on his feet on the ground. By this time, the other monks were coming out of their trances. Number 17 squealed like a frying squirrel when he saw the yeti so close. The yeti crouched and bared his teeth. "Stop that," barked Joshua to 17. "You're scaring him."
"Give him some rice," said Gaspar.
I took the cylinder I had warmed and handed it to the yeti. He popped off the top and began scooping out rice with a long finger, licking the grains off his fingers like they were termites about to make their escape. Meanwhile, Joshua backed away from the yeti so that he stood beside Gaspar. "This is why you come here? Why, after alms, you carry so much food up the mountain?" Gaspar nodded.
"He's the last of his kind. He has no one to help him gather food, no one to talk to."
"But what is he? What is a yeti?"
"We like to think of him as a gift. He is a vision of one of the many lives a man might live before he reaches nirvana. We believe he is as close to a perfect being as can be achieved on this plane of existence."
"How do you know he is the only one?"
"He told me."
"He talks?"
"No, he sings. Wait."
As we watched the yeti eat, each of the monks came forward and put his cylinders of food and tea in front of the creature. The yeti looked up from his eating only occasionally, as if his whole universe resided in that bamboo pipe full of rice. Yet I could tell that behind those ice blue eyes, the creature was counting, figuring, rationing the supplies we had brought. "Where does he live?" I asked Gaspar.
"We don't know. A cave somewhere, I suppose. He has never taken us there, and we don't look for it."
Once all the food was put before the yeti, Gaspar signaled to the other monks, and they started backing out from under the overhang into the snow, bowing to the yeti as they went.
It is time for us to go, Gaspar said. He doesn't want our company.
Joshua and I followed our fellow monks back into the snow, following a path they were blazing back the way we had come. The Yeti watched us leave, and every time I looked back, he was still watching, until we were far enough away that he became little more than an outline against the white of the mountain. When at last we climbed out of the valley, and even the great sheltering overhang was out of sight, we heard the Yeti's song. Nothing. Not even the blowing of the ram's horn back home. Not the war cries of bandits. Not the singing of mourners. Nothing I had ever heard had reached inside of me the way the Yeti's song did. It was a high wailing, but with stops and pulses like the muted sound of a heart beating, and it carried all through the valley. The Yeti held his keening notes far longer than any human breath could sustain. The effect was as if someone was emptying a huge cask of sadness down my throat until I thought I'd collapse or explode with grief. It was the sound of 1,000 hungry children crying, 10,000 widows tearing their hair over their husbands' graves, a chorus of angels singing the last dirge on the day of God's death. I covered my ears and fell to my knees in the snow. I looked at Joshua, and tears were streaming down his cheeks. The other monks were hunched over as if shielding themselves from a hailstorm. Gaspar cringed as he looked at us, and I could see then that he was indeed a very old man. Not as old as Balthazar, perhaps, but the face of suffering was upon him.
"So you see," the abbot said, "he is the only one of his kind, alone."
You didn't have to understand the Yeti's language, if he had one, to know that Gaspar was right.
"No, he's not," said Joshua. "I'm going to him."
Gaspar took Joshua's arm to stop him.
"Everything is as it should be."
"No," said Joshua, "it is not."
Gaspar pulled his hand back as if he had plunged it into a flame, a strange reaction, as I had actually seen the monk put his hand in a flame with less reaction as part of the Kung Fu regiment.
"Let him be," I said to Gaspar, not sure at the time why I was doing it. Joshua headed back into the valley by himself, having not said another word to us. "He'll be back when it's time," I said.
"What do you know?" snapped Gaspar in a distinctly unenlightened way. "You'll be working off your karma for 1,000 years as a dung beetle, just to evolve to the point of being dense."
I didn't say anything. I simply bowed, then turned, and followed my brother monks back to the monastery.